Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Discover Magazine, the June 2021 edition of Discover Magazine. And we're going to start this week with Tales from the Fringe. From Bigfoot to the anti-vaccine movement, fringe theories are everywhere, lingering in the shadow of science. Where do they come from? Imagine a universe rife with cosmic catastrophes. Jupiter ejecting a comet into space that would later become the planet Venus. The comet whizzing past Earth and changing its rotation. The resulting chaos on Earth causing natural disasters of biblical proportions, literally, like the parting of the Red Sea. In the mid-1900s, Emanuel Velikovsky, a psychiatrist and author, claimed that he could prove these radical ideas. Velikovsky laid out his case in Worlds in Collision, a 1950 bestseller. But the book wasn't billed as creative fiction or fanciful hypothesis based on anecdotal accounts of the past. Rather, Velikovsky presented these interplanetary theories and others as factual. Many scientists didn't buy it. That this is a remarkable story, no one, proponents and opponents alike, will disagree. Carl Sagan wrote in response to Worlds in Collision, whether it is a likely story is fortunately amenable to scientific inquiry. And inquire, scientists did. Many pointed out that Velikovsky's evidence ran counter to centuries of established astronomy and physics knowledge. His arguments were based on historical texts and legends. The whole affair reignited questions about what's science and what is pseudoscience, a discussion that precedes the coining of the latter word in 1796. You don't have to look far to find ideas that seem scientific but are not. Think of astrology, flat earth theory, or the anti-vaccine movement. But how do we know when an idea is rooted in scientific fact and when it's a mirage? It can be tricky to tell. The wide umbrella of pseudoscience encompasses ideas that come from a variety of sources, and they generally have little in common except that they've been designated as such by members of the scientific community. Part of the reasons why the fringe is so crazily diverse is because science is pretty crazily diverse, and that's according to Michael Gordon, a Princeton University historian. In his view, these ideas that linger in the shadow of science. This hints at the complicated relationship between scientific establishment and the fringes. Fittingly, another term for these schools of thought is fringe science, one that Gordon prefers after researching fringe theories since the late 1990s. Many fringe ideas are not inherently dangerous, but in some cases they spark valid concern from scientists, such as the claim that the COVID-19 vaccines can alter your DNA. When unfounded and false information is presented as scientific to skew the truth or blatantly lie, it can cause real damage in the world. There are some fringe doctrines where we have a very good reason to be antagonistic towards them, says Gordon. But he also explains that it's not the theories themselves that's the problem. It's that they look true, but they aren't. Fringe groups will wield bias-affirming data, anecdotal evidence, and the testimonies of people with academic credentials to make a convincing case. Even when these ideas are not rooted in fact, many people still latch onto the fringe theories, and in some cases deny contradictory evidence due to powerful emotional, political, and cultural influence, a taxonomy of fringe. While it might be tempting to lump every fringe idea into one category and every scientific idea into another, the theories seldom fit into tidy little boxes, and there is no single, universal way that they arise. Take Bigfoot, for example. While myths of wild human-like creatures are present in cultures around the world, a newspaper columnist in the United States was the first to use the name when writing about the Northern California loggers who spotted mysteriously large footprints in the woods. Despite that those footprints came from the jokester making marks in the mud with giant wooden feet, people continued to present videos and even corpses aimed at proving the creature's existence. Today, cryptozoologists search for evidence of mythological creatures using their own methods, taking Bigfoot from folklore into pseudoscience. On the other hand, astrology and alchemy were once seen as legitimate scientific fields before drifting to the fringe as understanding about the natural world progressed. The easy example of how we tell what is and what isn't pseudoscience is astrology, says Keene University historian Brian Regal. It's viewed as pseudoscience in part because it has never really evolved over time. As astrology and alchemy suggest, the barrier between science and fringe is not a brick wall. Ideas previously regarded as scientific have been disproved and dismissed. And in some rare cases, theories that were once regarded have gained peer-reviewed evidence and support by the scientific community. Atomic theory, for example, was once part of the fringe. Though scholars had theorized since the days of ancient Greece and India that atoms existed for centuries, the prevailing idea was that matter was continuous. Essentially, you can keep breaking it down into smaller and smaller pieces forever. It wasn't until the 1800s that scientists began to record concrete evidence for the existence of atoms, and more research was built onto that idea until the theory became widely accepted. Other scientific ideas we consider common sense today weren't always respected. Physicist Galileo Galilei triggered the wrath of the Catholic Church and scathing rebuke from his 17th century astronomy peers for proposing that the Earth revolved around the Sun. That's also roughly the same time period when Europeans were in the midst of scientific revolution. Though the roots of the mathematics, chemistry, and astronomy date back to ancient civilizations across the globe, Galileo and his peers began to codify the scientific method and laid the groundwork for modern research institutions. That's when you start to get this notion of pseudoscience, says Regal, because you get people who are now going to be operating outside that sort of growing community of the researchers and the scholars. The establishment of modern science created a barrier between the insiders and the outsiders. And it's important to note how science has routinely dismissed certain groups of people or actively pushed them to the margins. Researchers, for example, have historically skewed male and white, often overlooking diversity in race or sexual orientation. Even for Velikovsky, part of his support as a charismatic figure in the 1960s and 70s stemmed from the tension between the fringe and the mainstream. He was standing up against the elites at a time when anti-establishment politics were especially popular, explains Gordon in his 2012 book, The Pseudoscience Wars. Followers latched on to his outsider status. But the non-scientific method plaguing Velikovsky and his followers and much of the pseudoscience today was a reluctance to modify their ideas when presented with opposing views and evidence. Instead, they clung to them even more tightly. That abolitionist, all-or-nothing attitude is central to building a fringe movement, and it opposes how the science is supposed to work. Holding on to the past. Whatever you read in your school textbooks decades ago likely contained outdated knowledge, even if the fact seems rock solid at the time. And that basic notion of our change can be uncomfortable for many. Most people think science is a body of doctrine that's static, says Gordon. We figure out something, it's true, and then we put it on the shelf. But that's not always the case. Scientists are constantly revising their knowledge through new studies, data, and discussions. Stuff that you grew up thinking was true turns out not to be, he adds. And that disrupts people's faith in science. Consider for a moment Pluto. You may have had some strong feelings about the downgraded planet. Many people certainly did when the iconic celestial body was reclassified as a dwarf planet in the year 2006. A panel of 424 astronomers, less than 5% of all in the profession across the world, voted to change Pluto's standing based on a new criteria of what makes up a planet. The controversial recategorization is the official stance of the International Astronomical Union today, even though some astronomers still disagree on what exactly Pluto should be called. The scientific consensus will shift over time because people are constantly picking at it, says Gordon. And that's supposed to be science working as normal, but it has this byproduct. The incremental, fluid nature of science can lead to fringe thinking, he reasons, because people tend to latch onto whichever finding appeals to them most. Even if that scientific part is later debunked, they still might like it and hold on to it anyway. One textbook example is the repeatedly debunked claim that the MMR vaccine causes autism. The idea first arose in 1998 when former physician Andrew Wakefield and colleagues published a paper in The Lancet alleging that a causal relationship existed. The journal retracted the study 12 years after it was published when Wakefield and colleagues were found to have deliberately fabricated evidence for financial gain. In the aftermath of the initial report, though, entire communities began to stop vaccinating their children. Even though scientific reports have shown over and over again that there's no causal relationship between vaccines and autism, the damage has been done. Today, anti-vaccine groups abound, and once eradicated diseases are making a comeback as large clusters of people continue to shun the vaccination efforts. Experts and fakes. It may seem surprising, but the actual techniques and communication strategies that the fringe scientists employ can confirm humanity's basic trust in the scientific method. Exploiting that trust to spread false information is exactly how some fringe theorists get people to believe them. One common technique, explains John Cook, a communication researcher at the Monash Climate Change Communication Research Hub at Monash University in Australia, is relying on fake experts to give the impression that a message is scientifically credible. Fake experts are those with academic credentials who at first glance seem qualified to speak on an issue. Maybe they have a PhD or a doctor in their title, but their credentials do not match or they lack the expertise in the area of science that is being discussed. Essentially, someone with a doctorate in psychiatry is not necessarily qualified to offer expert insight on astronomy. And there are times when even scientists speaking within the area of expertise can muddy the waters. What if a credentialed climate scientist makes claims against the evidence for human-caused global warming? Well, in this case, dissenters can become lionized, as Cook puts it. While 97% of climate scientists agree there is evidence that humans are at least somewhat responsible for global warming, there is still a very small margin of experts who disagree. And when those dissenters are visible on TV debates and testimonies in Congress, they can take an argument with nearly 100% consensus and make it seem like it's split down the middle. If we're already primed to listen to these dissenters that are overriding the consensus, won't that make us change our minds? Well, if they're saying the stuff we want to hear, we just psychologically tend to think, now that person knows what they're talking about, says Cook. And that's why science deniers rely on these fake experts and their dissenting voices. Fringe in the wild. It's no secret that social media has become a breeding ground for false information. In many cases, online groups can become echo chambers where bias-affirming posts circulate, regardless of whether they're true or not. Public health expert Sarah Gorman does not shy away from the sticky virtual interactions that these posts might prompt. She dives in head first, armed with the knowledge that social media is a primary source of information for a lot of us. Gorman is the CEO of research and education nonprofit Critica, which is conducting a study to see which communication methods work best when interacting with people who share false health and science information on various social media platforms, including Facebook. Her team started specifically with vaccine misinformation in response to the deployment of the COVID-19 vaccine. Even before it was rolled out, unfounded claims that production of the vaccine was rushed or that it would cause serious side effects permeated the social media feeds. Gorman and her team use the Critica Facebook page to target comments or posts that circulate unfounded claims. Rather than simply flagging the posts as disinformation and include a link to a fact check, tactics used by Facebook and other social media platforms, her team will engage in a conversation with the user, In short, the team predicts that finding common ground with posters will be a more effective strategy, though they're still in the process of collecting data. Gorman says that the opening up of a conversation does a lot more to foster good communication than trying to lecture someone on why their beliefs are factually wrong. You might really talk to someone about, well, all right, we have a common goal. We both want to help keep children safe, she says. Then you help the person really unpack how they came to their beliefs. The method works best with people who are on the fence. Say they got the anti-vaccine misinformation from a friend's post, but didn't take the time to vet it. Another successful technique draws on the idea of psychological inoculation. Much like a vaccine safeguards you against disease, this tactic prepares people to identify the ways that people will twist the evidence online to make ideas seem scientific, like employing fake experts. The main reason it works is because people are averse to being misled, says Cook. Sometimes those kinds of posts are simply mistakes, and a lot of us make them. Research shows people on social media will often share false misinformation without seeing if it checks out first. One study published in the year 2020 found that people who share stories with false health-related information on Facebook don't always do it intentionally. In fact, many people share their posts with inaccurate information simply because they are distracted and hit the repost button based on a short description or a headline that they agree with. Gorman says many anti-vaxxers tend to fall into the on-the-fence category. However, it would take a lot more to convince someone who is the leader of a fringe group, such as Andrew Wakefield himself, to change their mind. Cook agrees. It's incredibly difficult, almost impossible, he says, not only because they're committed to their ideas, but also it's how they define themselves. It's their identity. That identity can make them feel like they're fighting for a worthy cause, even as they knowingly distort the facts. But in some situations, when a leader dies or fades away, so do their ideas. After Velikovsky died in 1979, his books and movements sank into obscurity. And like fringe ideas, even a scientific consensus can lose favor. We often only hear about the ideas that have stood the test of time and the rigor of repeated testing to gain widespread acceptance by mainstream scientists. Most things published in 2020 in Science are going to be wrong in about 10 years. And that's not a problem, says Gordon. That's how it's supposed to work. Jennifer Walter, the writer of this article, is an assistant editor at Discover Magazine. And we have a side article here, Spotting Pseudoscience. So, how can you tell the difference between science and theories on the fringe? The debate has raged in philosophical circles for centuries, but there are some tangible traits that most pseudoscientific theories have in common. Historian Brian Regal teaches courses on scientific and pseudoscientific history at Keene University in New Jersey. He breaks down pseudoscience into five traits, the first being that these theories do not advance or evolve over time. If you take what an astrologer is doing today, says Regal, and compare it to what Albertus Magnus was doing back in the Middle Ages or any of the other famous astrologers from that time, what they're doing really is not much different. Similarly, pseudoscientific theories do not present any testable evidence, and you cannot prove or disprove the theories. Science, by contrast, relies on the verification of evidence to prove or disprove ideas. As new data comes in, things that were previously true can be proven false. And supporters of pseudoscientific theories are often unwilling to accept any contrary evidence. Think of the so-called anti-vax movement. Even though it's been repeatedly proven that vaccines do not cause autism, some people still refuse to accept that evidence. And lastly, pseudoscience is often based on belief alone. No matter how many times a scientist debunk purported evidence of Bigfoot, enthusiasts will still believe the creature exists because they want to. Evidence be damned. Now let's head over to Hot Science. Did life come from space? Some astronomers hypothesize that asteroids and comets might shuttle biological matter between the planets. Life for all its complexities, has a simple commonality. It spreads. Plants, animals, and bacteria have colonized almost every nook and cranny of the world. But why stop there? Some scientists speculate that biological matter may have proliferated across the cosmos itself, transported from planet to planet on wayward lumps of rock and ice. This idea is known as panspermia, and it carries a profound implication. Life on Earth may not have originated on our planet. In theory, panspermia is fairly simple. Astronomers know that impacts from comets or asteroids on planets will sometimes eject debris with enough force to catapult the rocks into space. Some of those space rocks will in turn crash into other worlds. A few rare meteorites on Earth are known to have come from Mars, likely in this fashion. You can imagine small astronauts sitting inside this rock, surviving the journey, says Avi Loeb, an astrophysicist at Harvard University and director of the school's Institute for Theory and Computation. Microbes could potentially move from one planet to another, from Mars to Earth, from Earth to Venus. You may recognize Loeb's name from his recent book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth, which has garnered headlines and criticism from astronomers for its claim that our solar system was recently visited by extraterrestrials. Loeb has authored a number of papers probing the mechanics of panspermia, looking at, among other things, how the size and speed of space objects might affect their likelihood of transferring life. While Loeb still thinks it's more likely that life originated on Earth, he says his work has failed to rule out that possibility that it came from somewhere else in space. Meanwhile, recent experiments have suggested that earthly organisms can survive in space, at least for a little while. Experiments aboard the EXPOSE-E facility at the International Space Station have subjected bacteria, lichens, and plant seeds to the extreme cold and radiation of space for anywhere from a few days to over a year. Some bacteria and other organisms were able to survive the journey, including tardigrades, ultra-hardy animals found elsewhere from the Arctic ice to the deep oceans. If an asteroid or a comet is large enough, microbes could be frozen deep within, says Loeb. That could protect them from radiation and the extreme temperatures that turn the meteors into fireballs. After they explode onto a surface of a new world, the extraterrestrial colonists could begin to thrive. In other solar systems, panspermia could even be more likely to occur than in our own. For example, the 7 tightly packed planets of the TRAPPIST-1 system, which was discovered in 2016, might be ideal for life to planet hop. If we find life there one day, Loeb says, we should pay attention to whether it all looks suspiciously similar. He thinks 2 neighboring planets with similar biological systems would be a sure sign that life has traveled between them at some point. Loeb also hypothesizes that panspermia could occur even between distant star systems. Interstellar visitors like the recently observed space object Oumuamua and comet Borisov could spread life from system to system. Such a process could even begin on our own planet. In a paper published in the journal Life, Loeb looked at the possibility that asteroids or comets might graze the Earth's atmosphere dozens of miles above the Earth, picking up microorganisms floating high in the sky before heading out on interstellar journeys. He estimates that, though rare, a few such instances have likely occurred during Earth's lifetime. Even if an asteroid flyby did pick up a few microbes from Earth, it's highly unlikely that they would survive the journey, much less land on another planet with conditions similar to ours. But then again, we can't necessarily rule it out. I think we have time for one short one in hot science. Whatever happened to the hole in the ozone layer? Almost 40 years ago, scientists found a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica. Ozone molecules absorb UV radiation, acting as a sunscreen for life on Earth. Certain substances, especially the chlorofluorocarbons, the CFCs, once emitted by refrigerators and air conditioners, destroy ozone molecules in our atmosphere. That's why in 1987, the United Nations established the Montreal Protocol to regulate the CFCs. Did the treaty fix the hole in the ozone layer? Well, yes and no. Concentrations of the CFCs in the atmosphere have significantly declined, but they're not gone for good. Stephen Manzaka, a research chemist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says they've detected levels of CFCs in the atmosphere that indicate possible unauthorized industrial production. These could delay the ozone layer's recovery, but they don't mean that the game is over. The enhanced levels of CFC-11 that we have noted in the atmosphere represent an amount that will not by itself cause substantial additional harm to the ozone layer if those levels diminish and return to expected amounts quickly, he says. Well, that's all the time we have for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from Discover Magazine, the June 2021 edition of Discover Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.